C-158. Number 7B.
If we have seen through that claim, then at the point of soul, another claim of duality comes up and says, all right, I have seen that mind is the only creator, and in spirit that this only creator only creates his own nature, and through its own nature, as its own nature. But then the duality of the third claim of duality comes up and says, yes, but God can change one nature into the other, can change matter into spirit and spirit into matter. And so this is again a different claim which has to be met. And it has to be met by soul, because soul says God is an identity and it's not something that can change. It has an identity and it sticks to that identity, and because it is an identity, it cannot change its nature. It cannot change its nature nor another nature. It cannot change matter into spirit. You see, the claim is very often in the human mind and in the treatment and so on and in handling a problem that one goes to the point of spirit and says, "Oh yes, spirit can only create spiritually. Therefore, what I am going to do with matter?" Well, then we say, well, that can be changed into spirit. That can be spiritualized. You see, that's the claim of duality against soul. Soul says, no, you can't. You can never, soul can never change matter into spirit, nor spirit into matter. It has identity. And so, if we would go on in the line of this thinking to the force of principle, which he hasn't dealt in this chapter, but in the second record of creation, the claim of duality that comes up in principle is that it says, "Oh yes, that's all right. I accept that soul only creates through its own nature and as its own nature and cannot change its own nature," but it says, but with the help of its opposite nature. That man must help it. That there is no God, no evidence of God, if man doesn't accept it. If there is no human system to accept it. If there is no human system through which it can show itself forth. It's an enormous claim, which is worldwide, which says, yes, principle is all right, but God needs man in order to express itself. Without man, the beauty and holiness and genuinity of principle or of God cannot be shown forth. It needs a man. It needs a system of man. Then, in life, Mrs. Eddy shows that another sense of duality, claim of duality, has to be met. In life, the claim of duality is again different. It says, all right, there is no, a soul has identity and doesn't change, but that unchangelessness of nature is maintained through a cycle of birth and death. See, the whole natural science, when I talk with a natural scientist, with the biologists and so on, which I have done recently quite often, it's a very, they all say, yes, life is eternal. But they all see life eternal as a cycle of birth and death, of growing and decaying. But because the flower has the seed in itself, it is perpetuated, and see life. They agree that life is deathless, but through a cycle of growth and decay, and growth and decay, and growth and decay, through a duality. See, the belief in us is so strong, so deep rooted, that that life, that the deathlessness of life is based on a duality, namely of the duality of birth and decay. That we have difficulty in overcoming death. So the religionists all believe that our life is eternal, but they believe that we have to die in order to be eternal. That death ushers us sooner or later into eternality. That death is the door through which we reach life. And so, again, you see, we are faced here with a sense of duality concerned with life. So life, the singleness of life is that only life leads to life. That only life demonstrates life. That only life brings forth life. That's why we said yesterday, the word of life is only demonstrated by going through the word of life, by no other means. That the method of life is by going through the word of life. Whereas the claim of spiritualism and of duality is really that through a certain duality of a cycle of birth and death, we can make life enduring. That's not very put very nicely in English. I think that we can perpetuate life. Then we come to the sixth subject. There, another claim of duality is handled. It's a different claim. Namely, it is the claim that says, yes, truth is true, but error can curtail and can hinder truth. It is no more that it is a claim that truth can create truth and error, but she shows there that the claim is that as long as we have an erroneous standpoint, that as long as we take that we will not be partakers of the true life. Because it is the claim of duality that says error can prevent truth from demonstrating itself. And this is a belief which is very, very impregnated in our consciousness. In everyday life, somehow, consciously or unconsciously, we feel that error can hinder the march of truth, that error can oppose truth, can be a hindrance, can hamper. You say hamper truth? See, and this is only because there is still a sense of duality within our consciousness. And in that paragraph she says that until, you see, we begin to see life as the only life, until then we are not taking part in the real life. And then lastly, she comes to love, and in love we always have a very deep-seated sense of duality. After I have accepted, yes, that truth can never be hindered by error, can never be curtailed by error, can never be opposed by error, that truth is isness and is full power and is full savior and is the dominant savior and has dominion, that then we go to the last tone of love and say, and therefore God condemns evil or error. And through all the religions we have this damnation that God condemns evil. But God cannot do something like that, because God is love, is blessing, therefore he cannot do the opposite, cannot condemn and curse. And so in us is a sense of duality that we believe that God can do both, can bless and condemn. And in this chapter, in this part, she shows that God blesses all, but blesses all, and man does not know from whence it cometh. It's a spirit blessing man, but man cannot tell whence it cometh. By it the sick are healed, the sorrowing are comforted, and the sinning are reformed. These are the effects of one universal God, the invisible good, dwelling in eternal science. You see, it's all within one realm of love, of completeness, of inclusiveness. Where God not even can curse evil, because God cannot curse. And we know from the end of the story of the second record of creation that we should not curse anybody, that those who will curse Cain and so on, that they will curse seven times, and later 70 times, 70 times, and so on. It takes away the last sense of duality in the signs of spirit, which not even curses that which is apparently directed against God. There is but one being. And so solves really the whole sense of duality step by step, all the claims of duality step by step, to the last point where it just shows there is one being in which, in eternal science, and in that eternal science there is the invisible God. These are all fundamental questions, deep fundamental questions. And when I relate them one by one, as I have just done now, they seem to be so theoretical and academic, perhaps. But thinking them over and trying to find the practical consequences in our life, we just feel that we are impregnated with these various dualistic beliefs. Sometimes we think, if because we confess that there is only one God and not two gods and not many gods, we have made a confession of the monotheism of God, but we haven't. The claims of dualities are much broader, much more varied than just this one statement. And to think over these various claims of duality are necessary in order to come always closer to the monotheism of the one God. And that first part of spiritualism helps us to do that. After having presented true monotheism, which always, when it is presented fully, always leads to a true monism, then the second part comes and tries to bring in all the arguments against the first part. The second part challenges the first part and says, well, all that what you have been showing us in the first part sounds pretty good, sounds pretty logic and very pure and very sublime, but I can give you all the counter proofs from my human experience which show you that this logical pure deduction of the first part is not true, is not all. That there is still another creation besides that. And the second part brings up all these arguments, these counter-arguments against what has been stated in the first part. And that's very good, because in everyday life, these counter-arguments, can you say counter-arguments? These counter-arguments would come up anyhow and would have to be answered anyway. And so, let's see what these counter-arguments are. The first part has stated that only that which mind creates and mind maintains is the reality of being. And all that which mortal mind creates is not real, is not true. But the human mind comes and says, but they are true. Because it says that with the human mind and with the human belief, I can establish and create the universe which is very tangible to me. And it says, through the seven subjects, it says in the first subject, it says, but look at it, you can't deny that human thought is a creator. Because if human thought is fearful, it creates sickness. And if human thought is put straight, it can have a saving effect. So it says, you see that human thought is something. In the second subject it says, but you can't deny that human thought, mortal will, is cooperating with matter. Because you can't deny that. You can't deny that if there is a human will, that human will is cooperating with your muscles and with your arm, that you can lift that arm. You can't deny that. It goes further to the third and says, but you can't deny that many mediums are in contact with spirits and receive communications from spirits, and they tell you all sorts of things which you can't deny. So there is something happening within the realm of mortality. The fourth is that they say you can't deny that there is mind reading, mind with a small m, mind reading. Because there is such a thing as mind reading. In the fifth subject, the argument is and says, but you can't deny that that mortal mind can evolve extraordinary images and sounds and noises and pictures and I don't know what, that there are extraordinary phenomena. And in the sixth subject, we remember, it was shown that mortal mind comes and argues and says, but also with the human mind and with mortal mind reading, I can bring back to memory things which have been long forgotten, and with the human mind and I can bring forth sense testimony, the sound of voices long ago silent, the touch of a hand that has vanished long ago, and so on. I can produce phenomena which have the same sense testimony as your five physical senses have. And lastly, in the seventh, it shows, well, you can't deny after all that with the human mind I can produce quite extraordinary wonders. And she brings those various examples, among which are eloquence, that through spirits, through the control of spirits, through the control of mediums and so on, eloquence can be produced and can show forth wonders. And that in dream we can work wonders and travel afar and see pictures and so on, which are just fine. See, these are the counter-arguments which anybody will bring forth as disproof of the signs of spirit. as a disproof of the signs of spirit. And these arguments have to be met. They have to be met. Is there now a mystery? She asks, that on one side logic tells us only of the reality of that which can be deduced from God. On the other side, there seems to be phenomena which are produced by the human mind. What is this mystery? And can this mystery be solved? And so the second part solves that mystery in a very clear-cut way by pointing out that the difference is between the divine mind and mortal mind. That the first part, the monotheism of the first part, is a presentation of what is going on in the divine mind, and the second part is showing what is going on in mortal mind and in the realm of mortal mind. Remember how she says that mortal mind reading only touches its own beliefs. That mortal mind reading is that which argues always within its own realm, with its own realm of beliefs. But that mortal mind never has insight into the realm of divine mind, never can cooperate with the realm of divine mind, never has any contact with the realm of divine mind, that she uncovers there that these realms are completely separate. And then says now, what is the authority? The authority of the mortal mind realm is mortal mind and not God. It's hypothesis and belief. Whereas the realm of a pure deduction from principle is the realm of a principle. Which then, in the third part, she says, now, which one do you want to take? Which side do you want to take? The point is that you can say, now, what's the difference? The one goes out from principle, and he can have the realm of principle, and the other one has just the same right to go out from mortal mind and has the realm of mortal mind. So what's the difference? Well, the difference is, what she shows is that the one has a Christ and the other hasn't a Christ. See, these three parts in this chapter depict the first part, the Word, the pure analysis. The second part is the Christ. And the third part, Christianity. In the second part, she shows, well, that's quite true. You can have the realm of mortal mind, and in that realm of mortal mind, you also can work wonders and do things, but they have no Christ. They have no Christ. They are not the Savior. See, it says right away, it says already at the beginning, it says, well, what is that? Is mortal mind a savior if in one way it can make sick and the next moment it can relieve sickness? Is that a savior? A savior is always good. And Josie, she asks us to take the mind of Christ, which always does good. And so all through these various subjects, she shows that there is no Christ in the realm of mortal mind. That's the key point, so to say, for our decision then. Which side shall I take? The decision must be on that side where there is a Christ. The mortal mind has no Christ, you see. The mortal mind has no Christ. That's why mortal mind reading never does something which is progressive and can do anything which is progressive. That's why mortal mind can only bring out of, can you say, forgottenness, or that it can bring back things which have been secret and forgotten. But what is brought back is always mortal mind, never truth, never unlocks truth. Only the divine mind reading unlocks the truth as itself. What's the good if we would culture mortal mind reading, with which we could unearth all the forgotten things of thousands of years ago? If we would know what our grandmother and granddad did on the 2nd January of 1802, or what Caesar did when he visited his girlfriend or not, what's the use of it? Could write a nice novel, perhaps, that's all. But there's no savior in it. In this investigation and sniffing into mortal mind, there is no savior in it. And therefore the criterion. See, the criterion of the second part is, what has a Christ? Has mortal mind a Christ? Has mortal mind reading a Christ? Has mortal mind activity a Christ? Has mortal mind power a Christ? That it has power is certain. That he has power within the realm of mortal mind. That's why mortal mind can lift the hand. That's why spirits can lift the table. It has power, but always within the realm of mortal mind. It has no savior. And so our decision always lies on the side where there is a savior. So you see, I have to go on. So the second part really, you see, wants to teach us never to believe a belief. Never to believe first in mind that the human mind can do something. Never believe what the human mind thinks or does. I mean, in a treatment, really, this is the point where the practitioner has first to turn away to believe in a belief. It's turning away to believe, what she says there first, in what mortal mind says, because the patient will always talk to us something. Usually one has to disbelieve in the belief that what he says, what mortal mind says, is cooperating with any material situation, with the body or with an organ or with anything.